All right, so we're going to continue on our path that we were taking on Monday, where we were talking about the ferromagnet and the microscopic behavior there and the phase transitions that one could see in really the phase diagram. And so we talked about how ultimately we know the ferromagnet is a quantum mechanical phenomenon, and it's due to all these spins that align themselves or they do not. And so we talked about how what we want to do is develop a microscopic model for this ferromagnet. So from before, we were looking for a model to simulate ferromagnet. And we said we were going to have a lattice with some spins that live on the points of the lattice. And that each of these spins has two states, up and down, and we're going to assign a variable sigma I to each of these spins that could be equal to plus or minus one, depending on the orientation of the spin. And so if we let some just general sigma be equal to a vector of all of these, let's say n spin variables, then we're looking for some expression that we could then use to compute a partition function where we're doing e to the minus beta times some energy of sigma. And so this energy expression is what we want. And so what we know now is that the ferromagnetic phase transitions can be simulated or modeled with what is known as the Ising model. And the definition of this model, in terms of this sigma vector that I've mentioned, is going to be minus J coupling times some nearest neighbor sum of sigma I, sigma J. So this notation with the brackets represents two nearest neighbors. So, for example, this could be I and this could be J. You could also have vertical bonds or horizontal bonds. These are just a sum over all the nearest neighbors. And then we have a term for which allows us to apply an external magnetic field as well. Okay, and so like I said, I'm going to think of sigma I equals plus one for spins in the up direction, sigma I equals minus one for spins in the down direction. And if we think about the physics of this, what is this energy expression telling us? Basically, the interaction term favors nearest neighbor spins, to point in the same direction. And you can see that pretty quickly by just looking at the possible ways that the nearest neighbor spins could be pointing. And what you see is that in the case of them both being up, or in the case of them both being down, you know, so this is some I and this is some J. We're going to get minus J, sigma I, sigma J. And then if we have plus one times plus one or minus one times minus one, what do we get?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this is going to be equal to minus J. On the other hand, if we have one spin up and one spin down, so that's plus one, minus one, or the other way around, the first spin down and the second spin up, that's plus one, then again, we're going to have minus J, sigma I, sigma J. But now one is positive and one is negative, so this is going to be equal to plus J. And so you know what we're doing is minimizing the energy. So the point is that this case where they're both pointing in the same direction is energetically favored. And so this is one of the simplest models we can come up with these nearest neighbor spins. And because of that, there are actually some exact solutions, which we'll discuss somewhat. But that is the main idea of the physics for the interaction piece. And then the second term, which is going to be familiar from last week when we were talking about non-interacting systems. This term is the magnetic field, external magnetic field. And it's really what we had before. For the paramagnet. Because if you take this Hamiltonian and you assume that J is equal to zero, then what you have is a bunch of non-interacting spins that don't align each other, and you just have an externally applied magnetic field at that point. So you really just have the paramagnet system in the Hamiltonian if you set J equal to zero. And then there's an order parameter, which I mentioned. And I really plotted in terms of the ferromagnet on Monday, which is the magnetization. But now we can define it in terms of these microscopic variables. And that's just going to be a sum over all these sigma i's. Because if all the spins are pointing up, we will have some maximum number, really a plus n at that point. So I've normalized this by the total number of particles, so this magnetization will range from plus 1 to minus 1. On the other hand, when they're all pointed down, we'd get a minus 1. And in a disordered phase where they're all random, we should get an average of 0 in that case. So there's no order, and so we don't get anything for the order parameter there. And then in 1D, there is no finite temperature phase transition. This chalk is okay. So basically TC, where we discussed, you know, these regions where we were greater than or less than TC. In 1D, it turns out that TC is equal to zero. And so you do have ordering at T equals zero, but you have to go down to that temperature. And actually, the Ising model, it was originally studied by a PhD student. His advisor, Lenz, gave him this problem. And it turned out there he looked at it in 1D and found that there was no phase transition after all. And I've heard different accounts. I've heard one person who's rather senior saying, oh, that's so sad, he published that one thing. And then he didn't really go on after that and publish more things, and there was no phase transition. I also heard from a PhD student friend, you know, this is really the best story. You do one thing for your PhD, and then your name goes out everywhere, and you're famous for the rest of your life, and you didn't have to do anything else after that. So I guess you can take, you know, glass half empty, glass half full look to that. But I do think it would be pretty cool, you know, to have your name on this. And also, I lived in German-speaking areas for about a year. It's supposed to be Ising model, but I still will always say Ising, because I, whatever you hear first, I think you're just kind of stuck with, so. Okay. So let's talk about the phase diagram. So we talked about on Monday when we had these plots of the H ordering field versus the magnetization M, which we've written out in equations now, that H ordering field and this order parameter M. And when T is less than TC, because we do have a finite TC for these higher dimensions for 2D and 3D and so on. So when we're looking at T less than TC, we have some H field that will decrease the magnetization will decrease as you decrease the H ordering field. However, it never goes to zero, and there's a discontinuity here, and we have a first order phase transition at this spot. And then on the other hand, when we have T greater than TC, we have this paramagnetic type plot when I'm looking at H versus M. And we have no transition. And then right at T equals TC, when we're looking at H versus M, we have these orderings, but then right at zero, we have an infinite slope. And so we have that dm over dh is infinite at h equals zero in this plot. So the susceptibility becomes infinite at that location. And so I'm going to take these plots and really put them in the full context of the phase diagram now. because this isn't really the phase diagram, but it's just an idea of what's happening to the order parameter with respect to H at different temperatures. So for the phase diagram, I'm going to plot T versus H here. And I'm going to put TC here because it's somewhere along this line. And basically what we're going to see is that when we are below TC and we're up here, we're going to have a ferromagnetic state. And then down here, we also have a ferromagnetic state, but the spins aligned in the other direction. And then we have a full line of first order phase transitions here. So this picture is really a snapshot of one of the plots you could show here, because we have some sort of constant temperature, and then we are looking at M versus H as we move from positive H down to negative H. So, in fact, I can even, the plot would be something like this. This plot would be one of these. And then right here at T equals TC, we have the second order phase transition. And this plot really corresponds to that location in the phase diagram. And so it's right here that we have the susceptibility blowing up. And then over here, we are in the paramagnetic phase. And so this plot is really corresponding to one of these times greater than, one of these temperatures where T is greater than TC there. So I sort of said it in words before, but I'll just repeat it. In 1D and 2D, the Ising model is exactly solvable. And you will solve the 1D version in your tutorial. The 2D version is much more difficult to solve and was solved by Onsager. And then in 3D, it's still an open question. And there are plenty of people who think, you know, it's not going to be solvable in 3D and higher. And then in 4D and higher, when it comes to the universality, the critical exponents actually become easy to compute. And we're going to see that today. Well, we can use something called mean field theory. I'll just mention that. So any questions so far on this? Give you all a little bit of time to finish writing.
Mm-hmm. When you say nearest neighbor spin, you mean that, for example, in one date, if I have a spin here, so it means the one next to it and the one previous to that?
Exactly, both directions.
And in 2D, that would be?
Yeah, in fact, we're about to get to that, but yes, in 2D you have a little plus sign, right? You've got the up, down, and right and left.
Mm-hmm. So somehow, I guess so. One would expect like the 3D icing to be easier to solve than the 2D because it's closer to mean field, but then some like 2D miracle that like does not make this happen.
Yeah, I mean, both 2D and 3D end up being pretty non-trivial in a lot of problems. I mean, you could say 2D is also closer to 1D, right? Just as 3D is closer to 4D, you know?
Mm-hmm. I was wondering about the definition of second-order phase transition. Mm-hmm. For Van der Waals interactions, we had both vanishing first order derivative and second order derivative.
Yes.
I think it seems that here for ferromagnet, the second order derivative vanishes, but the first order derivative diverges. So I was wondering what.
Yeah, so this is the order parameter, not the Gibbs free energy. So if you did the Gibbs free energy for this model, you should find that it's second order.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that definition was in terms of the Gibbs free energy.
Oh, okay.
Now, what we will do later on in this lecture is we'll talk about the more modern, typical definition of second order and continuous phase transitions in general that we will probably use for the rest of this course. And that one is easier to see from these quantities that we pay attention to here rather than the Gibbs free energy.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay, so let's think about mean field theory. As I mentioned, it's pretty useful. It's going to give qualitatively correct results, actually, in all the cases except for the 1D case. And for 4D and higher, it gives quantitatively correct results, too. Leads to qualitatively correct results in more than one dimension. So the idea for mean field theory is we're first going to rewrite the Hamiltonian. And this is just going to be in a way that makes mean field theory easier to write out. So I'm going to write my energy in terms of the spin configurations. And I'm going to introduce a factor of 2, which I'll get to in a moment. I'm going to sum over some site I, and I'm going to sum over some site j, where j is one of the nearest neighbors of I. So basically, I'm going to write out this nearest neighbor notation a little more explicitly. Sigma I, sigma j, And then the sum over the sites is simple as always. And the idea here is, well, just as we were talking about, I'm going to think in terms of the 2D lattice, though this will generalize for higher dimensions as well. And so if I'm thinking about one site, I want to connect it to all of its neighbors in the different directions. And by the way, I'm going to be using a notation Q for the number of nearest neighbors, also called the coordination number. So we have this site, and it's going to connect to Q of the nearest neighbors. But there's an issue if we just count this in a simple way, like that. Because if we think about two sites that are next to each other, and I'm going through all my sites and then counting their connections to nearest neighbors, I would say, hey, this site is connected to that site. So one is connected to two, let's say. But then when I get to this one, I would say two is connected to one. That's the same thing. So I would be counting everything twice. So we compensate simply by introducing the factor of 1/2 here. So each bond is counted twice. So we have a factor 1/2 to prevent, or really to fix, overcounting. Okay. So I haven't really done anything yet. I've just rewritten this energy in this way, but nothing has changed so far. So now we're going to do the really the approximation and really the mean field theory way of thinking. So first, let's say now let's think from the perspective of spin zero, so the spin that is at site zero. And what we're going to do, and I'm just going to use this notation for the energy of the interaction from the perspective of site zero. So this is just going to be one term in a Hamiltonian. And what we're going to do is approximate it as minus J sigma zero. And then, you know, for any of these spins, they're going to have Q nearest neighbors. And it's called mean field theory, so there's going to be some average involved. So I'm just going to say Q, but then all of its sum over nearest neighbors I'm going to replace by Q times the average value of any spin in the system. And then this is a little ambiguous. You know, is this the average spin for a configuration in the system, or is it the average spin at equilibrium? you know, because this energy is for particular configuration. So I'm going to further say this is actually, I'm going to approximate it as, oh, now that's really a mess. Minus J sigma zero Q times the magnetization. Where remember, we've defined the magnetization as 1 over the total number of particles times the average spin. Times the average spin at equilibrium. And so then, if we think about including the piece, this H here, because now what we have is something that involves a single spin times numbers, right? Well, the same is true for this H field. We have something that involves a single spin times an H field. So really what we're saying, if we're thinking about the terms with E0 for the full Hamiltonian, what we have is our minus JQM minus H times sigma zero. And we could think about this as an effective magnetic field. And then we're really back to the paramagnet again. So I'm just going to write this out. Every spin feels this effective magnetic field. And it now looks like a bunch of independent paramagnets. So let's recall what we had in the case of the paramagnet. And so this is going back to the lecture that we had a week ago, thinking about the paramagnets. So from before, we could have written the energy as a sum of sigma i's times mu little h sigma I. That was the new notation I used then. And then what we got was that the magnetization, which by the way, I didn't normalize it a week ago, but I'm going to normalize it here for comparison. Because a week ago I had the magnetization varying from plus N to minus N for N ferromagnets. I'm going to write it here where it ranges from plus 1 to minus 1 to be consistent with what we have. So that was minus 1 over n we got from partial f partial little h at some temperature. And then we got this expression mu times the tanh of beta mu little h. So then in our analogy, so by taking mu just goes to 1, because we don't have this extra mu here, I'm going to say this is the whole H effective field with mu equals 1 here. So taking mu equals 1, and then that little h instead as our is going to be our effective field, which was minus jqm minus big H. We have that m is equal to the hyperbolic tangent of beta, because I'm going to keep the beta here, and then mu was 1, h is going to be h effective, and then, yeah, and then it's the, I should have, oh, this should be minus here, that's right, that, then the analogy goes through completely, okay, jq m plus h. And well, we haven't really done much of any work here, and there are complexities to this, which I'll get to. But it's pretty crazy that we do this, and it turns out that this leads to quantitatively, not just qualitatively, but quantitatively, correct answers for D greater than or equal to 4 for the Ising model. Any questions so far on the idea here?
So this is like an implicit equation for M?
Yeah. This is the equation really that we, as you can see, it's a bit different because this was in terms of the ordering field. But yeah, this is an implicit equation for M. And we will do some plots and figure out what it actually means a bit later on. But before we go there, I do want to talk about some of the complications here, because they can lead to some major confusion and homework and that sort of thing when you're looking at trying to think through mean field theory for problems. When we look at this, we really did things in a fairly simple way, and we got something that ends up being correct. But I do want to have a warning here. If you're looking at this Hamiltonian, and then you just want to write it as, if you write a partition function, and you write it based on a total energy as equal to the sum of the energies at each site, because remember, I was thinking in terms of the energy for site 0 here, and so if I were to write it in this way, this would lead to inconsistent results. Which what I'm saying is basically if you calculate f from z and then you minimize f, then the equation for the magnetization would be different. And the reason for that is if you look at the energy expression as a sum of these E sub I sigmas, we have minus JQM times the sum of the sigma I's. And I'm just, I guess I can include the other part too. This is the minus H sigma I. We have this issue where this overcounts the energy. Because notice if I take this and I compare it to what I had up there, I had to have that factor of 2 in there to keep myself from overcounting them. But then when I was thinking about the energy for a single particle and the magnetic field that it has, there's no factor of 2 there. So it looks like a bit of a paradox, you know, with what we're seeing. And this is something that comes up a lot of times in the homework of, you know, there's a factor of 2 here, but there's not in there. And if you took it and you had a factor of 2 in this equation for the magnetization, that wouldn't actually be correct. There should be no factor of 2 for the magnetization. It really is feeling a magnetic field, you know, with all from that come from all of its nearest neighbors, not just some of them. And so basically, this is not the correct energy expression for mean field theory. Well, I mean, this one is basically because everything's the same up to a constant, but if we had a factor of 2 in there, that would not be correct. And so let me just give you the corrected energy expression. Is actually E equals the same thing as I have up here, JQM times the sum over I, sigma I, plus a term JQ magnetization squared N over 2. And there. And then we have minus H sigma I. And you see, so I still have that minus thing with the overcounting, but then I'm going to add a factor with, notice that this sigma I is like an could be approximated as another magnetization. And so when I add this, the total energy has that minus factor of 2. Now, I'm not going to, other than saying that, okay, the counting looks correct in general for this, I'm not going to justify it because my lecture notes in the last section give the derivation. But basically, the steps are, we can obtain this from writing that sigma I is equal to sigma I minus the magnetization plus the magnetization. And of course, that's completely true. And then when you expand out, so this is starting from the original Hamiltonian, what you'll do is you'll have terms that are sigma I minus M times another sigma j minus m squared, and those are higher order terms, and you ignore those, and then you will arrive with this Hamiltonian expression. So it's kind of a, I mean, this is why all this stuff is, you know, it's really cool that you can get something correct from something very simple, but there are also many ways you could go wrong, you know. You could think a tiny bit about this and then arrive at this completely correct expression. You could think a little bit more and end up at something wrong, this is right here, and then you could think even further and then finally get back to the right answer again. But so I did want to note that, because this is something that will come up in homework too. When do we see at factor of 1/2? Because if you wrote it down in the straightforward way with j over 2, you know, and then had some effective magnetic field, you could end up with a factor of 2 here, and that's not correct. It really is a fact that each particle is feeling the effective field from all of its nearest neighbors. It's like, I think Landau says something out, you know, you have to be wrong in the correct places, basically. So something to think through. Okay. So let's just remind ourselves we have this. Okay. So then we can get, if we take this one, we will get the same answers by first doing df dm. We're going to, again, minimize the free energy at some finite temperature. And then, so we can get that, because if we calculate the partition function, we can relate it to the free energy as a reminder, times minus kT log z. And as I said, this minimizing free energy thing, I showed more of a hand-wavy heuristic last week. Giuseppe actually has some notes that I've included too that walk through the model and really give a rigorous mathematical justification in this case for why you can do that. Okay, so yeah, enough of that throat clearing, and let's actually think about this implicit equation and what's going on with it. So if we have m equal to the hyperbolic tangent of theta jq m plus h. Okay, and so then first we're going to think about when we have h equal to 0. And then what we're going to do is we're going to have to do some plotting to really understand what types of solutions we have to this equation, because it's an implicit equation in terms of m. And so I'm going to start, and I'm going to plot a couple of functions, basically, in terms of n. We know that if we have the tangent, well, we know what its long distance behavior is. We know it'll go to minus 1 on one side, it will go to plus 1 on the other side. And then if we're thinking about when we're right here, so basically for when beta jqm is small, so we can write when beta jqm is small, we can use, does anyone remember, and this is really just to first order, when tangent of something is small, let's say when tangent of x is small, how can you approximate when the hyperbolic tangent of x is small, how can you approximate it? Though it's the same for the tangent, actually.
Just x?
Yeah, it's just, you can just approximate it as x. So it's going to look linear in this region. And so for the first case, I'm going to say beta qj is less than 1. So there's going to be some linear slope here, and then, you know, or at least approximately linear, and then we're going to go to these limits on either side. But then if, and so let me go ahead and write what this is. This is the tangent of beta j qm. And you know, it's going up and down to these values of 1. And then on the other hand, so that's sort of this side of the equation. And then this side of the equation is just m. So, you know, if you want to plot m as a function of m, you just get a line and its slope is going to be equal to 1, right? So this line had a slope that's less than 1. And then I'm going to also plot this, which is just m. And this one is going to have a slope that's just 1 everywhere. And so what this equation is saying is, hey, when is m equal to the hyperbolic tangent of this stuff? And in this case, when this beta qj is less than 1, they're only equal at one point, and that is at m equals 0. On the other hand, let's think about beta qj greater than 1. So we have a point at 1. We have a point at minus 1. And then I'm going to plot this versus m. I'm just going to plot the line first. And then in the case where we have that beta qj is greater than 1, again, when we're close to here, this argument, which includes the magnetization itself, is small. But now the slope is going to be steeper here. And remember, the whole point is to look for where we have these two things equal. So I'm going to write the hyperbolic tangent here. There's this line, and then this line is just m. We're actually going to get 3 intersection points, so 3 solutions to this equation. Okay, and now I see the problem with this board because, yeah, I don't want to put anything in front of it right now. Okay. So basically what this tells us is that we can get non-zero magnetization, and basically we get that m is equal to plus or minus m, little m. So let me just call these, you know, these points as little m here, and this point as minus little m there. When we have that beta times q times j is greater than 1. Which, if we remind ourselves that beta is equal to 1 over kt, that tells us that when we have that q j over k is greater than t, or that when T is less than QJ over K, and guess what? That's what we're going to define as our TC. So when T is less than some value, that corresponds to this scenario where we can have non-zero magnetization. When T is greater than that TC, we're in this picture where we only have one solution that M is equal to zero. And remember, we're just solving for zeros here. What we would actually find is that if we were looking at the free energy at this point, these two would be minima and this would be a maximum in that case. So we really have those two magnetization values when T less than TC. Any questions on this?
Is this critical temperature the same as in the exact solutions, or is it a different temperature?
Yeah. So let's talk about that. So in 1D, we know that it's straightforwardly incorrect because this is saying that the TC is equal to 2J over K, and we know that the critical temperature there is zero. I only wrote down it for 2D, but it's a similar story in 3D. In 2D, TC is approximately 2.27 J over K, whereas this is saying it would be 4 J over K, because there are four nearest neighbors in 2D. So the mean field theory is basically, it's saying that the critical temperature is generally higher than what it actually is. And that's what we see in general for 3D as well. Basically, it underestimates the effects of thermal fluctuations. So it thinks that you're going to be able to have a non-zero magnetization at a higher temperature than you actually would need in reality. In reality, you have to go to a lower temperature before you can see that. But in 4D and higher, yes, you can just use this. Okay, so let me just be explicit here. Different, smaller than the mean field theory prediction, which was TC equal to 4J over K. So now that we have this expression, actually just from that implicit equation, we can actually get critical exponents. Exponents. So as a reminder, we have that M is equal to the hyperbolic tangent of beta times JQM plus H. So then we can solve beta JQM plus H equals the inverse hyperbolic tangent of M. And then what you can do is you can approximate that the inverse hyperbolic tangent of x is approximately x plus 1/3 x cubed. And you do have to go to a higher power here for the inverse hyperbolic tangent, because what you'll find is when you expand is this in terms of the m, we will actually get some cancellations to first order. We're going to get that M plus H over KTC, and I've written this in terms of TC now, so that's why that JQ is going to go away, is approximately equal to m plus 1/3 m cubed. And like I said, we're going to get an m in both sides. So then the m's are going to cancel. So that's why we needed another power here in order to figure out what the magnetization is actually doing. And while this is going to look pretty familiar, because now we have h related to m, and h is approximately m cubed, or you could say m is approximately h to the 1/3. And so that's our delta equals 3 critical exponent that we saw in the van der Waals model as well. Does everyone have these diagrams over here? Okay. Okay, so similarly, we can get that m is approximately, and I think I'll include the, I mean, I'll put the notes online for this because I don't really have time to get into it. So you can also look at m and its behavior in terms of Tc and T, and that again just comes from this magnetization equation. And so then that is actually going to tell us that beta is equal to 1/2, as we had before. And then chi, you can get from the derivative of the magnetization with respect to H. And when you do this, you'll get that chi goes as 1 over k t minus tc to the minus 1 when t is greater than or equal to tc. And h goes to 0. And that it's 1 over 2k tc minus t to the minus 1 when t is less than or equal to tc. And so then you get that gamma is equal to 1. So from this very simple implicit equation for the magnetization, you can just get all of these critical exponents as well for the mean field theory. Okay, let's take a 5-minute break and then we can go on. Yep. You're not going to be able to do this in your head. It'll take some working out.
If you had to plot this diagram for finite H, mm-hmm. you also get 3 intersection points.
I see. So for finite H, no. So at finite H, you will have 1 magnetization at that point because it forces everything. This is something that you see if you don't have any H ordering field at all.
But I think that if I add a constant to that, then that just shifts my tangent to the right. So provided that h is within the right range, you should still have 3 points now.
Yeah, that could be the case. And then it comes down to which point is at the minimum. And so the point over here, if you're minimizing the free energy, is going to have the lowest value, or you know, is going to be the one that minimizes it. In fact, we'll get to this in Landau theory on Friday, but we'll actually see, well, there are two minimum, but the system will rest in the lowest minimum of the sort of the what you have, because you are minimizing the free energy, and then so which one actually gives you the lowest free energy, and that value is going to be the one that is in the same direction as the H ordering field. Because we'll actually see that on Friday. If you think about the free energy, you can get something like this. This is when it's when there's no favoring, but then you can also get something like this. Mm-hmm. And so they're still minima, but one is lower than the other one. And that tells you where you're
saying is adding H gives you this.
H shifts where yeah. H.
Shouldn't it shift everything by a constant, or does it shift one?
Well, I think you're right. It shifts these things, but this doesn't actually tell you what this does to the free energy. This plot.
Okay.
Yeah. This just tells you where the solutions are, where the maxima or minima are.
I mean, so if you have a symmetric free energy like that, mm-hmm. How does the system pick which one to sit in?
Yeah, so that's where if you are, so on average, the system will pick one half the time, the other half the time. It just comes down to the thermal fluctuations, you know, as you're lowering the temperature.
So that's an example of like
spontaneous symmetry breaking.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, sorry, what were you going to say?
It's like you said, two symmetry, right, of the system that.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm.
Emily, so how many exponents should we check for different systems to make it fall into same universality class?
Yeah, so what we're going to learn on Friday is actually only two of these critical exponents are independent. So
really?
Yes. So that's one thing. But what you'll learn in some other courses, and I think what I'll touch on in kind of the bonus fun lectures, there are other theories called CFTs that have all sorts of scaling dimensions. So then there are many more things that you could look at. Okay. So I wanted to make some notes about this now that you've seen the Ising model in general, and the simplest form, which involves these nearest neighbors, is the one that Ising originally looked at. And so, due to RG, the critical behavior, it's going to actually remain the same if you change several different things about the model. And it would remain the same, for example, if you have some disorder. And what do I mean by disorder? Well, that would involve taking J and making J not be all of the same J's, but giving it some dependence on IJ. You know, with some fluctuations. So this isn't really an unstable thing. You can change aspects of the model a bit, and you will still get the same universality. And then also, you could give it longer range interactions. As long as they decay. Fast enough. And so this really does point to the utility of this RG thinking that we'll be getting to next week. And I also wanted to give a sort of qualitative understanding of two additional exponents that I haven't discussed yet, and these are the eta and nu exponents. And you'll see why I haven't really calculated them at this point, and why I waited to discuss them after I tell you a bit more about them. But they're not really complicated as a concept. It's more of in terms of finding a simple model to compute them is harder. So there are two critical exponents I haven't discussed yet. And the thing with them is that they are both related to correlations. So if we continue to think qualitatively here, let's think about phases, and let's think about what I'm going to call the correlation length. Which we represent using C. So if I'm in an ordered phase, then we can think about all of the spins pointing up. And then if we think about some spin A and some spin B, in the ordered phase, you see as far as you can go, basically, that even these spins that are on opposite corners that are far away from each other, you have that A is correlated with B. And this will correspond to a large correlation like C. Because you know that if A is up and we're in ordered phase, this spin way over here is also going to be up. But if A is down, we also know that this spin way over here will also be down. And so the correlation length is related to the length of the correlations in space between spins. Now, on the other hand, if we have a disordered phase, and you know this is where I pretend to be a pseudo number generator, and I'm not even a good pseudo number generator, but you know, try to put the spins randomly in a configuration, and let's think about A and B. And actually, in this example that I give of a disorder phase, they happen to be pointing in the same direction, but they just happen to be. You know, half the time they'd be both pointing in the same direction, half the time they'd be pointing in opposite directions. And so there's no correlation between A and B. So this would correspond to small xi. So these are just useful sort of heuristics to keep in mind when we're thinking about correlations and the correlation length. Okay, so then if we think about how we would get these eta and nu exponents, we can get them by taking measurements of correlation functions. And so, quite simply, if you think about a correlation function for these two spins, it's just going to be the average of sigma I times sigma j. And then you can have a background subtraction if there are some non-zero values for the individual sigma I and sigma j's. But the important thing here, it really is a simple observable. We're just saying, hey, is this spin at location I correlated with this spin at location j? And so for a continuous phase transition, speaking more generally, if I think about a correlation function and I use an r to be distance between the spins, we will get that this correlation function goes as r to some minus power t, but that's dwarfed by this exponential decay that's related to the correlation length. So I can measure this function and compute it, and I will find this relation. And then the important thing for continuous phase transitions is that at exactly t equals to tc, the correlation length becomes infinite. Because this is really the transition point and where you start finding correlations between spins that are as far apart as they could possibly be in the system. And so then the correlation length, t, is going to go as t to this minus nu critical exponent. So that's how nu is defined. Nu tells us how the correlation length becomes infinite as we get to the critical temperature. And then also, at t equals tc, if you think about this correlation length becoming infinite, what is some number over an infinite thing? Zero, yeah. So that means we have e to the zero, which is one. And so g will actually go as a power law right at the critical temperature. So we get that g of r is going to go as r to the 2 minus dimension of our system minus this eta. And that's the definition of the second critical exponent, eta. This is also called the anomalous dimension. And the reason for that is if you were to look at this correlation function, and I know that you're already thinking about these in quantum field theory, and where you have a field theory and you're calculating various correlation functions, you can see from dimensional analysis, when you've got these two things, these two operators, that you would expect the dimension to actually be 2 minus d in the decay. But at the critical point, it's 2 minus d minus eta. And so the eta is sort of anomalous, and it's special for whatever particular system you're looking at. It's another critical exponent. And so that's how you define the eta. Okay, so with that, we start getting an idea of why I haven't done any examples of calculating these yet. Because if we think about mean field theory, we just took the average of all the spins. So we really can't look at any interactions here. So we have no interactions used. And so no correlation info. We just have this idea of each spin interacting with the average spin. And the average spin is the same, no matter what spin we're talking about. So there's really no way to make sense of, hey, if I'm looking at this specific spin A and this other specific spin B, how are they correlated with each other? So mean field theory really removes that kind of information from the model. And it's useful for getting those alpha, beta, gamma exponents, but there's no information there that would really tell us about eta and nu. So we will need more sophisticated methods to get eta and nu. And so that's really where statistical field theory will come in, because we'll be able to write something as a field theory and really be able to look at interactions then and correlations between particular fields. And so I also, now that we've talked about all of these things, can give you the modern classification of continuous phase transitions. And basically we get these from divergent susceptibility of a system. Which we saw that when we looked at the plot of M versus H. And we also saw that in calculating the critical exponent here. Because remember, we got chi going as t minus tc to the minus 1. This is where we get our gamma equals 1 critical exponent. The other thing that we use to characterize the continuous phase transitions now, so that's second order, third order, et cetera, is infinite correlation length. so do we have this this new critical exponent where the the correlation length goes to infinity? And then finally, this power law behavior. Of GR at the critical point. And so, you know, this is where we have our GR going as R to the 2 minus D minus eta. And so far, we've really only been able to see directly the divergent susceptibility from this mean field theory. But we will be able to see these other things as we go on in the course. And I think that's pretty much what we have time to discuss today. So happy to take questions. One thing I do plan on doing on Friday, you will get the exact solution of the Ising model in your tutorial. And so since it's an exact solution, we can actually look at correlations for that. So we can look at the correlation functions in 1D at least and see the, how what happens to the correlation length as we go to TC equals zero. Well, t as we go to t equals zero, because tc is equal to zero, yes.
So here, correlation length is infinite, meaning that nu is necessarily positive, right?
Yes, nu is a positive value.
And what about
all of these critical exponents are defined to be are positive.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
The behavior of Z, Xi, and everything will be different if we studied the phase transitions at Kerb space time.
Say again, if the phase transitions?
Phase transitions at Kerb space time.
In curved space time. I see. Yeah, so in curved space time, as long as you. Yeah, this all is going to. The continuum limit ultimately. So everything I think should be flat. So I think you should get the same ones. Now, what is the case is for certain things, like if you had a conformal field theory and you studied it on a sphere, you would get the state operator correspondence, which is a relation between the energies and the scaling dimensions here. And you wouldn't get that for any, you know, any manifold. It had to be, would have to be on a sphere in that case. But you can always get, I think, these critical exponents by looking at the observables. But I don't know that much about when we say, so I would suspect it'd be the same. But.
What is the exponent of R in the first expression for G of R?
This. Yeah, this is just something I'm calling a tau. This is just some power. Yes.
This is the state equation.
So that's for like.
In general.
In general, if we're not at critical temperature, we're
yes.
Correlation.
Yes.
So here, the correlation C of T is proportional to T,
you say that
small t?
K t?
Yes.
T is a deviation from the critical temperature.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. No. So T, it could be either way. Because we're sorry, you got T minus TC over TC. Yeah, it's this reduced temperature. How far away are we from the critical temperature?